From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. In 1968, a television show made its debut as a mid-season replacement on NBC for the canceled spy drama The Man from U.N.C.L.E. The new show was called Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and it was a national phenomenon. I never missed it. No one wanted to miss it. And in those days, there were no VCRs or TiVos, so, you know, if you missed something, you missed it. So when I saw television historian Hal Erickson had written a critical history of the show, do you think that I was interested in talking to him on From the Bookshelf? You bet your sweet bippy. The book is called From Beautiful Downtown Burbank. Hal Erickson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you, Gary.
Tell us a little bit about the television landscape of 1967, 68, into which Laugh-In arrived.
Well, you got to remember that at that time there were a lot of variety shows, but most of the variety shows were very standard. They'd start with the monologue, they'd have the opening sketch, they'd have the music, they'd have a closing sketch, they'd have the guest star spots. Nothing really to shake it up or anything like that. Most shows were very traditionalist. Most went from beginning to middle to end without really shaking up what was had been done since the early 50s.
And also at that time, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. had been a pretty successful show up until that season, I guess.
That's correct. It started dying that season. The whole spy craze started dying around 67. So Man from U.N.C.L.E. was a victim of that.
And at the same time, in the movie industry, that was the period where the production code was beginning to break down, and we started to see movies like Bonnie and Clyde and The Graduate and so forth.
Yeah, that's correct. The movies were beginning to weaken the production code, but television was still pretty strictured as far as it came to censorship. We still couldn't see Barbara Eden's navel on I Dream of Jeannie, for one example of many.
You mentioned that in the book, and I had to go back and look. I seem to remember seeing her navel, but no.
I'm going to show you didn't.
No, I didn't. But Laugh-In was so tell us about Laugh-In. Laugh-In arrived in 1967 and 68, I guess, was the premiere of the actual series.
Well, there was a special in the fall of 1967. There's a confluence of talents there. Dan Rohn and Dick Martin had just come off of a very successful summer replacement show for the Dean Martin Show, and were looking for a series. The producer, George Schlatter was looking to put a series on, and many of these two talents and several others got together to do the special in the fall of 67 with the hope that it would eventually become a series. They didn't expect it to become a series so quickly, but when Man from U.N.C.L.E. was canceled, Laugh-In was ready. And so it went on as a mid-season replacement, which had a precedent. Batman had been an extremely successful mid-season replacement 2 years earlier. So NBC, although it was taking a chance, wasn't taking as big a chance as they would have done in previous years, premiering an important show like that right in mid-season. So it opened on January 22nd, I believe, 1968.
And how did it differ from those variety shows that you were discussing a minute ago?
Well, when you saw Laugh-In, you literally did not know what was coming and when it was coming. The show would open with about 10 different comedy bits. The monologue may happen 5 or 10 minutes in, may happen 15 minutes in. There were regular sequences, but you didn't know where they were going to be. You didn't know who was going to pop up because there was a whole bunch of cameo, what they call cameo appearances of guest stars who would pop up and tell a joke. It was very free form, very quickly cut, because most shows were done in the traditional long shot, medium shot, close up, but this was cut to the point where some of the images lasted only an eighth of a second, which was quite remarkable in those days. Now, and as I said, you literally did not know what was coming next.
And how did they achieve that cutting? Because now I don't believe there was any such thing as computers, really, or anything.
No, there wasn't. This had to be literally done by hand because there was no way to cut in the video like you can now. The very talented man who was editing it was a man named Art Schneider, who had been nicknamed Jump Cut by Bob Hope, who he'd worked with for years because of his talent at editing tape. And it would take quite a few sessions. They'd have a seven-hour laugh-in tape, and they would work literally around the clock to get that thing within the hour-long frame by the time the show went on.
So you're saying that for each week they shot 7 hours of laugh-in?
There was at least 7 hours of material. They didn't always shoot 7 hours of material. Sometimes they'd have so much material left over they could build a whole new show around it. There were at least two or three shows a year that would build up of material that had been cut out of other shows. But there often was between 5 to 7 hours of raw tape that they had to get down to an hour. And that was Art Schneider's great talent, which he had to do literally, he had to do on the fly. He had to look at the tape, look at where the emulsion marks were for the sound in the picture, which you couldn't see, of course, on tape, and then use a razor to cut it. And it was a very difficult process. He sped it up, however, by making a kinescope or a movie taken right off the television. And then he would edit that. He'd often edit it three or four times to get the film of the tape down. And when he got the film of the tape, he used that as his guide. It was still a very laborious process.
So
nowadays, you could put a show together like that on your computer in like 2 hours.
So even after he had got the final kinescope version, then he still had to go back and actually do the editing on the video.
Oh, yes, and even then there were still changes made at the last minute. If something topical came up or some new joke or some joke became old, or if, God forbid, some famous person they were joking about had died or something like that, they had to snap it right out. And it was almost right up to the time they delivered it to NBC at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday night.
Now, did they ever have an occasion where they had to do some cutting between the Eastern Time broadcast and Western Time broadcast?
The Eastern and Western Time, no, they'd never really had to do any serious cutting. They would always make two copies. One would go to the East Coast, one would go to the West Coast. The censorship problems, oddly enough, those were usually solved in rehearsal and during performance. They had two or three NBC censors on the set. And, of course, they would bicker, they would kind of bargain. If you let us use this, we'll cut that out. They still do that.
We're talking with Hal Erickson, and his book is called From Beautiful Downtown Burbank, and it's a critical history of Rowan and Martin's laugh-in. I remember the show as being a pretty sexy show. I mean, there was a girl in a miniskirt that got covered with water every week.
Oh, yeah, Judy Kern. Yeah.
And there was Goldie and the dancing.
Goldie Hawn, yes.
And the dancing.
From the third episode onward, Goldie Hawn, yeah.
So did they have censorship problems?
They got around the one thing. I mentioned the naval problem before. They got around that with, if you remember the show, they would always show a girl dancing with body paint. And she'd have a bikini on, or usually a very revealing outfit. What they did was they painted the belly button to look like a flower or a daisy or a light switch or something like that. It was kind of very childish, but that was the kind of things you had to do with the censor. They had to be very careful with the jokes that they did. And again, they had to bargain. I mean, we'll let you do this joke if you let us cut that. But what happened was George Schlatter would be sitting with the censors, and he tried to deflect them by laughing uproariously at something that wasn't happening at the time. For example, there was a gag in which Judy Kern was standing out on stage, and her wig flew off, really revealing a bald wig. And her line was, "I've never been bald on TV before." And immediately, of course, the two censors started bristling, and George Schlatter turned around and said, "Isn't that hilarious? Isn't that funny? She hasn't got any hair on. Get it? She hasn't got any hair on. Ha ha. She hasn't got a hair on her head. Look at that. Ha ha." And of course, she's laughing at that and getting them off the idea of the double meaning. And he would do that all the time. He would always be there trying to deflect the censorship or trying to diffuse the censorship.
You also mentioned in your book that he instructed the band and members of the audience not to laugh at certain jokes so that the censors wouldn't be aware that those jokes were...
Right, that was another thing. He would say to them, just don't laugh at this, and then they won't know. Of course, the audience at home will know, and when we do the show, we'll sweeten it with a little bit of laughter, but right now, don't laugh at that. Don't let them know, right. And that was very difficult with the band, because the band was very easy to break up.
Now, we mentioned Judy Kern and Goldie Hawn, and there was Alan Seuss, Joanne Worley, Artie Johnson, Where did all
the Henry Gibson, important person, Henry Gibson.
The late, great Henry Gibson.
And Ruth Buzzy.
And where did these people suddenly come from nowhere? They were suddenly...
Well, they didn't exactly come from nowhere. I think Goldie Hawn was the only one you could really call a newcomer because she hadn't had as much experience as the others. She'd done dancing, and she had a supporting part on a sitcom called Good Morning World, but most of them were veterans. They had done stage reviews. That was a style that they don't do much anymore. It'd be a play where they would have comedy sketches and musical sketches and things like, kind of no plot to them. Henry Gibson was a trained actor. Artie Johnson came out of the comedy review format. Ruth Buzzy came out of musical comedy. She'd done a lot of stage work in California and elsewhere. Joanne Worley also came out of the musical comedy stage. Many of them had quite lengthy careers. In fact, Artie Johnson once made the point that he felt that he was washed up in show business by the time he got laughed at. He was in his mid-30s at the time, and he'd had some reverses, but this kind of was more of a comeback for him. Whereas Henry Gibson had become popular on talk shows doing his poetry and his Southern accent so well that a lot of people thought he really was a Southerner. And Judy Carn had been a leading actress on three sitcoms before the show was on. So most of these people were veterans. They didn't pluck these people out of the skies. They got them out of the nightclubs, musical comedy, and television. They knew who these people were.
I remember Love on a Rooftop fondly.
Yeah, Judy Carn's last sitcom. It was another that show was a critical success. Did not do well in the ratings, but Judy was already a known commodity when she got on that show.
So
Sakatumi, Toomey, of course, made her world famous.
Well, I guess Laugh-In really was the thing that put all of these people on the
mm-hmm.
map. And Rowan and Martin, for that matter. I mean, they had been around for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Rowan and Martin had been a team since the early 50s. They'd only had moderate success. They were lucky in getting a strong supporter in the famous columnist Walter Winchell in the 50s. But their popularity had waxed and waned. I mean, there were hundreds of comedy teams in those days. But as I said, they managed to luck into a summer replacement show in 1966, and they were trying to push a show on television. And you're right, it was their star. That was their breakthrough. That was their big moment.
It seems like there's even sort of a divide between mm-hmm. Rowan and Martin and the cast of regulars.
Yeah, that was the thing, and that was something interesting. Originally, when George Schlatter was pushing his idea of Laugh-In, there were so many different ideas, it's difficult to determine who came up with it. He didn't really want a host. He wanted to have a kind of a formless thing with comedy flowing, but the feeling was that there was so much wacky comedy going on and so many things happening that the audience might have gotten lost or might have gotten, disoriented. So they needed an anchor. They needed somebody normal on the show to be kind of the voice of normality while all the craziness is going on. So they got a very conformist comedy team, Rowan and Martin, to stand there, and the audience could say, well, they're relaxed, they're normal, I guess I can be relaxed too. And of course there was also the announcer, the great Gary Owens, who would have this beautiful, mellifluous speaking voice, but he'd say the most ridiculous things, but he'd say it with such somber gravity that it seemed to make sense. So Rowan and Martin were a very important aspect. I don't think the show would have succeeded without having them as the anchor to the show.
And what was their involvement, on a day-to-day basis with the show?
Their involvement on a day-to-day basis, Dan Rowan actually was more involved in the creative end. Dick Martin was a fun-loving guy. He was a hard worker, but he wasn't really as involved in the creative aspects. Rowan was the harder worker of the two as far as the creative input. They were there at all times. They didn't really write their monologues, but the monologues that they got were in their style, and they would rehearse them, and they'd make changes that would make it work for their style. And, of course, they also involved themselves in the various sketches. But it wasn't one of these things where the star, like Jackie Gleason, would come in the last day rehearsal, or Dean Martin wouldn't even come until the day of shooting. These guys were there all the time, along with the rest of the cast.
Uh-huh.
So they were very much involved.
Now, what about the political aspects? This was, 1968, and the Vietnam War was going on.
Yeah, the political aspects. Well, the big political show at the time, of course, was the Smothers Brothers show, which was of course left of center and very anti-establishment and all that stuff, there was political humor on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. But the interesting thing was they tried to be balanced about that. Well, sometimes, however, the balance curiously went instead of to the left but to the right, even though most of the comedians, most of the people on the show had a liberal stance, because the head writer was Paul Keyes. And Paul Keyes was very tight with Richard Nixon. In fact, he was one of Richard Nixon's speechwriters. Paul Keyes, in fact, was the fellow who talked Richard Nixon into being on the show, on that very famous show that was the opening of the second season, which he said, "Sock it to me."
And there are some people who say that that's how he got elected president.
It's very likely. It completely altered his image. He had that image of being that kind of aloof, sullen, distant guy. But when he came out and said that, audiences warmed to him. And Paul Keyes was very tight with him, to the extent that there was some friction there, because they felt that he was kind of going soft on Nixon at a time when Nixon didn't deserve it. And George Schlatter, on the other hand, was more liberal, and there would be the jokes about the problems in Vietnam. Not really jokes, but there would be comments, there would be sketches, there would be very pointed barbs about Vietnam, but nothing to the extent that it was so overwhelming as the Smothers Brothers did, that it might alienate older audience members. They really tried to go for a broad audience. And to do a broad audience, you really had to avoid doing any kind of humor that would be attacking one side too much or attacking the other side too much. There was only one exception that they had, and that was George Wallace. Nobody liked George Wallace. So at the time, the famous segregationist. And Dick Martin, in fact, made a point. He said, "Well, we're getting a complaint. We're having too many anti-segregation jokes. But how in the world can you be pro-segregation?" And that was their attitude. And Wallace was cut no slack on that show. Nobody liked him, and they really gave him a hard time. But for the most part, the show was very balanced, not as political as the Smothers Brothers, which may have been why they managed to stay on the air so long. As you probably know, the Smothers Brothers had an awful time with CBS with that.
And we're yanked off the air.
And we're yanked off the air, which did not happen to Rowan and Martin. It may seem like they were playing it too safe, but you've got to remember this was 1968 to 1973. There was the so-called silent majority was still buying most of the products that were on television, and that's where most of the audience was. So they really had to be careful. They could do the barbs, but you had to do barbs on both sides.
This is a groovy life.
This is a lot of fun.
I may be black and blue before the season's done.
In spite of chicken jokes, we're telling everyone
that it's a socket to me.
Very interesting.
Cool, cool, laughing world. Tight.
We never hold a grudge.
If worry's in the way,
we give a little nudge.
We let it all hang out
and yell, "Here come the judge."
'Cause it's a socket to me.
Very interesting.
Cool, cool, laughing world. I just want to swing. Is this the Twilight Zone?
It must be outer space.
And lovely downtown Burbank is the place
where ballerinas quack
and run around the block.
And everybody says, "Knock, knock.
Who's there?"
Gehörten Flinder.
Gehörten Flinder who?
Gehörten Flinder said, "For the man, a woman, and a dog."
By Henry Gibson.
The elevators work, but never up and down.
We're wearing roller skates beneath a velvet gown.
We think that Charles de Gaulle is really quite a clown.
'Cause it's a socket to me.
Very interesting.
Cool, cool, laughing world.
My life is just like a tug of war. One big jerk after another.
It is with a heavy heart that we continue.
If we get really bored, try a nutty trick.
If something lays an egg, we pull another stick.
Is that a chicken joke?
We always end the fun by saying
good night, Dick.
'Cause it's a socket to me.
Very interesting.
Cool, cool, laughing world.
What was the question?
It's a socket to me, socket to me, socket to me, socket to me, socket to me.
Interesting.
We're talking with Hal Erickson, and his book is called From Beautiful Downtown Burbank, A Critical History of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, 1968 to 1973. Well, I said the show was a phenomenon. Back me up. How phenomenal was it?
It was amazing. This is a Monday night, and it was considered a death slot because you had two very popular shows on CBS. You had Gunsmoke, followed by The Lucy Show, and nobody ever beat Gunsmoke or The Lucy Show. Man from U.N.C.L.E., in fact, had been put there and died. And when Laugh-In went on, it was like it started out in literally a graveyard slot and shot to the number one show by within 13 weeks. It was enormous. It was what they would call water cooler stuff, because the next day, if you went to school or you went to work, you'd talk about the crazy things that happened on Laugh-In. And, of course, the catchphrases, very interesting, is that a chicken joke? And, of course, Sammy Davis's famous Here Come the Judge were just instant catchphrases all over the country. And I kind of trace that back to the very first show, in which they pulled out of nowhere, without any warning, the singer Tiny Tim. And if you remember Tiny Tim, he was this very strange-looking man with long, stringy hair. He sang in a falsetto voice, played a little ukulele. And he was such a bizarre character that audiences, it was like you saw that and you went, what in the world is this? We've got to stay on this show. We don't know what's going to happen next. And that may have been the turning point of that first show, but it really was an overnight sensation. It was enormous, absolutely enormous.
I think the show, and I know you agree, kind of overstayed its welcome, but it did later seasons introduce Lily Tomlin to America.
It did. About the third, halfway through the third season, Lily Tomlin came in. She'd just come off of another kind of more conformist variety show. Curiously enough, she was tried out on a show the last day of 1969, which was the day she was given her dismissal by the Laugh-In people because they weren't sure how she was going to go over, because they hadn't seen her on television. But when she came on and she did the Ernestine and the telephone operator and Edith Ann, they said, "Oh no, we got to get this girl back." And yes, she was one of the reasons that, when the third season came around, there was, as usual, there's always a little bit of slack in the ratings, and here comes a new personality with a new bunch of characters, and it really not only made her a star, but breathed new life into Laugh-In. And that's what the show constantly reinvented itself, bringing in new people, changing the within the format, that kind of stuff. Yes, Lily Tomlin was a huge success.
And Goldie Hawn, who went on to win an Academy mm-hmm. Award while Laugh-In was still on the air, was she the first to actually leave the show voluntarily?
Yes, she was. And it wasn't because she got along with everybody on the show, and she was very grateful for the chance of being a huge hit, but she really didn't like being typecast as a dumb blonde, and that really wasn't her fault. The first couple shows they were on, they were just going to have her being a cute girl who was announcing the next act. And what had happened was, Goldie Hawn had always, when she'd acted, been used to learning her lines. Well, they threw her cue cards, and she had never worked with cue cards before. In fact, there is some theory out there that she may have had difficulty reading, possibly a dyslexic problem. And she would read something, she'd start giggling if she didn't understand, or giggling if she thought it was funny. And they thought, that's so cute, let's keep that in. And it made her look like an airhead. Well, she wasn't an airhead, it's just that they were throwing these cue cards at her. And the harder she worked to be serious, they would write obscene things on the cue cards, dirty pictures, they'd make faces at her just to get her to laugh like that. And, of course, she immediately became the nation's sweetheart, very, very endearing personality, but she really wasn't that crazy about being typed as that character. She was in therapy through most of that. And the other thing was, she was very terrified of the trap doors. If you remember the show, there was always people falling into trap doors. Well, she had a phobia about this, and she was really, really, she got to the point, she got so nervous, she was having nightmares about falling through the floor. So essentially, she left basically for her own peace of mind, also because, frankly, she was too big for the show when she won that Emmy. But it wasn't because she got along fine with everybody in the cast, and everybody loved her, and the problem was just simply she felt that she was confined by that show. She was kind of roped in to a character she didn't want to play the rest of her life.
Now, jump to 1973 and the end of the show. Was everybody still friendly then, or was there bad feeling?
Most of the impression I got when I was interviewing and was writing to people was that if there were problems, they could be ironed out. The only major problems were between Rowan and Martin, the actors, and George Schlatter and his partner, Ed Friendly, the producers. And those, generally, Rowan and Martin won that argument because they were the stars, they were out there. But towards the end, they had to bring in a whole bunch of new regulars, and the show was getting tired, and it just didn't gel like it did in the past. They just weren't getting the people who were impressive enough, and the comedy was getting flabby, and it was also beginning to look old-fashioned, because by the time Laughing got to the last season, everybody was doing stuff like Laughing, the quick cuts, the quick sketches, the risque humor and all that stuff. So Laughing actually looked kind of like it was trailing everybody else. I think there was a feeling of being tired there. However, there were still some people from the first. There were still Ruth Buzzi, Gary Owens, and Rowan and Martin who survived all six seasons and managed to get through that. But I think it was not so much people not getting along as just the show was getting tired.
It got to the end of the line. Let me ask you about the infamous, you couldn't really call it a spinoff, but I guess you can, a turn-on. What was the story?
Oh, yes. Well, this is an example of, it sure looked like a good idea at the time. As I said, George Schlatter and his original writer, main writer, Digby Wolf, had always wanted to do a show that was all conceptual humor, no hosts, just one gag flowing into the next. This is how they had really envisioned Laughing. So they managed to interest ABC in a half-hour variety show called Turn On. And here's where they would just go crazy. They would use cartoon animation. They would use really fast cuts. They would have music going through the whole thing. The credits would be running through the whole thing. There would be no form to it at all. And they got this showing on an 8:30 one evening, and this is literally the first show that was not only canceled after the first episode, it was canceled during the first episode. So many of the ABC affiliates were offended by the show, and if they weren't offended by it, they were confused by it. People were turned off by it because there was nothing to latch on to. And also, the jokes were top-heavy with sexual humor, much more so. On the Laughing, the producer, Carolyn Raskin, always knew when to pull off and say, guys, let's stop doing this, we're going too far. Well, and this one went way too far, at least by those standards. There was a whole long sketch about a picture of the word sex and two people making kind of lewd faces, suddenly intercut with a shot of the Pope. Now, that doesn't mean anything now, but in 1969, that was like the ne plus ultra of scandal. And literally, every station that ran this thing was being swamped with calls. Get that thing off. This is the dirtiest thing I've ever seen. One station actually canceled the show in mid-show and started running its own programming. And the show was literally killed in one day.
The book is called From Beautiful Downtown Burbank, A Critical History of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. It's a brilliant book, very well researched, and the author is Hal Erickson. And thank you so much for spending some time talking about Laugh-In with us today.
You're very welcome.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. And in the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank Hal Erickson for being my guest this week on the show. I'll see you next time for From the Bookshelf. This is Gary Shapiro.